This is Leo Baybue for KTWH, Two Harbors Community Radio at 99.5 FM. We're streaming online at ktwh.org. I have the pleasure this morning of visiting with Danny, and I'm going to try to get your French name. I have a French name, Desjarlais. Is that close enough, Danny?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Desjarlais is, Danny is a member of the Lower Sioux community. That bears some attention paid to, you know, what your community is. I believe you're of the Dakota people. Also, we sometimes say Mdewakanton Sioux community. Can you give me your bearings of where your people are? And I think you have relations in some spread across a couple of other states as well at other communities.
Yeah. So we are from the Lower Sioux in Morton, Minnesota, the southwest corner of the state.
Okay.
And it's a very, very small landmass, the reservation that we were left with. We were spread out. There's, you know, Dakota tribes throughout the state of Minnesota, but then also throughout other states that got dispersed and displaced, I guess. And yeah, I don't know exactly if we're the smallest landmass reservation, but we have to be pretty close. If not the smallest, I think we have a total of 2,000 acres is our total land mass.
And all down there near Morton and in one place. It's not in little patches, Danny, or is
yep,
there some?
Yep. It's not checkerboard okay. Throughout the state or anything. It's just one little patch along the Minnesota River. So
now, of course, we're not going to go into it but in depth, but a lot of how you are on the land today relates to the fallout from the 1862 conflict. I assume that your people have borne the brunt of that in your history, and the land base that you have right now, as I understand it, is not exactly the best farmland, fair to say?
Yeah, that's very fair to say. And so when the reservations first started, you know, they gave us, or they let us keep this big piece of land that was on both sides of the river, stretched, you know, basically across the entire state. And then as time went on, they slowly took pieces of that back. And then we were left with a really small piece where we are now today. You talk about the 1862 conflict. It actually started right where our reservation still is now today.
Oh, my. I did not know that.
Yeah. And so the building where they kept our rations is still standing. It's a big stone building. I could actually send you a picture of it, but that building's still standing, and it's where they would hold our rations from the government. And then they stopped giving us the rations, and people, you know, started starving, and they asked for their rations. And the guy that would give out the rations told them if they're hungry, let them go eat grass. And, you know, the conflict started, and the first people they found dead was that guy and his son with grass in their mouth. And so that all happened right here on our reservation. The Birch Coulee battlefield is still there, you know, within a couple miles from here. But the land they left us with, I don't know exactly what years or when it happened, you know, because then they basically took everybody and exiled everybody. You know, the Dakota were exiled from the state of Minnesota. And so we weren't left with any reservation at that point. We were exiled from the state of Minnesota, and the Dakota are still exiled from the state of Minnesota. But the way we ended up getting our reservation, or the reservation we're on now today, is that some people that, like some of the families, came back to the area and started purchasing a chunk of land, and the only land they could get was basically a gravel pit. You know, it was basically sand there. There was no black dirt. The massive land grab that happened after they exiled us. People took all of the fertile land, and so they weren't going to give any of that back because they were already establishing farms and everything on that, you know. And so the piece we did get back was basically just a small piece of sandy soil that, you know, don't really grow anything. And so it was literally a gravel pit, and so we turned it into a gravel pit and made money off of that. And that's how we got our first income as a community once we were back to being, you know, I don't know exactly how the reservation was established
right then,
you know, how the state or the BIA, I'm sure it's through some federal government stuff, that when it actually becomes a reservation, and you know, however they did that, you know, I'm not like a history buff on that thing, but that's just, you know, what I know of how we got to where we are, that we have left, you know, and it's still a really small piece. We keep trying to purchase more and more. Like, I think last year the council might have purchased another 200 acres and started farming that as well. And so, you know, we'd love to get a lot of this land back, but it's a touchy subject.
Indeed. The reason we're talking today connects to that ability to grow crops. And you're in the Minnesota River Valley, right? And you're surrounded by pretty much some of the most fertile land in Minnesota or even the entire nation, right? But you have had, as you put it, largely a gravel pit to work with.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And the soil all around us is, like you said, you know, it's the richest soil in the state and the country. I think the county next to us always leads the nation in soybeans. And so there's, you know, great soil surrounding us. We don't have that.
Right.
That luxury. Yeah.
So, you know, and as we move ahead and from when you got that land base, as humble as, you know, that ground might be for what it can produce, to the later part of the 20th century, Native nations found an opportunity in gaming, but there are prospects for more sustainable ways of proceeding that I hear apparently you had a member of your tribal council become aware of the many uses of hemp, the agricultural product that was not allowed to be grown for a number of years. But can you tell me a little bit about how, I believe it was Earl Pendleton, who was on your tribal council, started looking into the prospects for something that you couldn't yet grow legally for production, but he kind of led the way into rethinking what else you could do on your land for sustainable economy?
Yeah. So like I tell everyone, you know, Earl is a true visionary. For him to be able to see this so far ahead of everyone else, you know, hemp and hemp buildings been around for a long time, but not here in the U.S., you know, and not even hemp has been legal until 2018. And he was pushing for hemp long before that. And yeah, you know, and his whole goal was to always have this full integrated growing it, processing it, and building with it. You know, the end goal was always to have these hempcrete buildings. And so it just sounded crazy, you know, especially back then. And it still, till this past year, sounded crazy to us because we didn't have any hempcrete buildings before then, you know. And so he is a true visionary on how he knew, you know, like how big this was. And I don't think any of us still till now even know really how big this is, because it is really big what we're doing. I'm not saying we're anything special, but what we're doing is very special because it's a blueprint for any community that wants to take back their sovereignty and wants to give their community members jobs and better housing. And so it's, you know, it's really big. It's his vision for this whole thing is just huge, and he was pushing it for a long time. And because it did sound crazy, and nobody's seen a hempcrete house here in the state of Minnesota or anything, and there was only a few in the country, it was probably scary for the rest of the tribal councils or anybody that he would bring it up to that he was working with. You know, they probably were like, yeah, okay, you know, because he was pushing it for so long, and I don't think many people really did believe it or even listen to it, you know, when he would be pushing it. And yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, I can put myself in the shoes of Earl with understanding that once this agricultural product, which was a traditional crop across North America, hemp, but had fallen into illegality, I mean, he had to envision that, you know, that we'd come to our senses as a country and make it legal to grow this valuable crop again. And then there were all the pieces of the puzzle that then would still have to fall in place. So I can see both sides of the skeptics saying too many things have to happen, Earl, and Earl saying, but they can happen and we should start preparing for it. And where did you come into that, Danny? I take it you're a little bit younger than Earl and had been coming up in the construction ranks and probably doing conventional housing and never seen such a product.
Yeah. About hemp, you know, when I think about hemp, I think about like Jack Herrera and the protests and the big rallies on getting industrial hemp legalized in the late 90s and early 2000s, okay. And I would read in, you know, High Times magazines and stuff, and that's what I thought. But then I would think, he wants to get industrial hemp legalized. What is industrial hemp? When I thought of industrial hemp, I would just think of, like, rope, you know, or paper, you know. I never thought of,
yes,
you could build houses with this stuff, you know.
Yeah, and fiber.
That's thought, you know, it was just kind of, you would read these things, and then that was it. It was like this oddity almost, you know. And so even when Earl started talking about building houses with it, it was like, wow, you know, you can build houses with this, you know. And I never really looked into it. But then he came to I was in a carpentry school, and he came and spoke about hempcrete. And, you know, he started talking about how he was speaking with the guy who wrote the book on hempcrete, you know, and I didn't even know there was a book about hempcrete. You know, like I said, it sounds like an oddity. And so once I started, you know, I looked that book up, and I started reaching out to Earl and asking him, hey, you talked to this Alex Sparrow guy? And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, and telling me all this and that. And so he seen that I was interested, and they were going to a building summit, a hemp building summit in Austin, Texas. And so he basically brought me down there and showed me, you know, there's an entire building industry already being developed here in the U.S. And that's where I was sold on it. You know, that's where it opened my eyes and made me, you know, like a true believer and like, wow, this stuff, you know, there's already all these projects and all these amazing people that were, you know, top in the industry here in the United States, and they were all there presenting their projects. And it was basically, like I tell everyone, it was the start of the rest of my life, because now I'm dove basically all in. And that's where I came into it, I guess. And so Earl kind of just basically handpicked me and said, okay, when we were down there in Texas, he was told us, you know, this was already, you know, 2 years before we even built. And he says, I'm going to have you running our hemp block factory, you know. And so he already had plans for prefabricated blocks.
Wow.
Back then, before we even. So, I mean, he is a true visionary. You know, I call him the Earl of Hemp, you know. And so he is. And he really is, you know, like, he is amazing. I've heard him speak. I've heard many people speak about hemp. You know, I went to that building summit, great people, the top people in the industry. I went to another building hemp summit in Colorado, listened to all those people speak, and they were all great. And then I've heard Earl just wing a speech in front of audience of people. And I mean, it's amazing. And so he really is the Earl of hemp. And so we're blessed to have him, you know.
You sure are.
Showing us the way, I guess, or giving us the vision. And then we're also blessed to have other leadership believe in him, you know, because he had to have other people say yes as well.
Yes, indeed. And then investments, had to be made.
And then we're blessed to also have continued investment into our crew. And, you know, we brought consultants in from all over the country that are the best at what they do in hempcrete. And they've taught our crew right on site. They've been side by side with us and helped us in these projects. And so to have our leadership and our current tribal council to still invest in us, it's really big, you know, because they could have just stopped after one season of growing hemp or something and been like, okay, that's enough, you know. But for them to invest in it and to continue investing in it is really something special. So
indeed. And Danny, I just want to break into, we have people joining us listening on the radio this morning, and I wanted to tell people why they're hearing the word hemp thrown around on their community radio station up here in Two Harbors. And I've got Danny Desjarlais from the Lower Sioux community on the line with me. And Danny's official title, is this quite right, Danny? You're the Industrial Hemp Construction Project Manager?
That's right.
That's pretty impressive. And yet, I think we have to, for anyone, and that includes me, I've seen a lot of videos now because you gave me some great links, Danny. Thanks for that. For me to become excited just from my armchair looking at videos of hempcrete being placed in walls. But I think everyone out there in our little community radio station's footprint that we reach a few hundred square miles, none of us have seen hempcrete. And we want to think about what that term even means. I think you have a good way of explaining. It's not really concrete. It's hempcrete, and this is what it really is. Maybe you could share with people what all the product is and what it actually is useful for in construction.
Yeah, the term hempcrete itself is pretty misleading because it makes you think it performs like concrete, which it doesn't. It's non-load-bearing. It's non-structural. It is self-supporting, so it does hold itself up. But it is basically your wall infill, your wall insulation. And so it is just the inside of the stem of a hemp plant, basically broken up into wood chips mixed with a lime-based binder and water. And you just mix that right on site, and you would place it right into the wall, whether you're going to spray it into the wall or if you're going to just cast it by hand. Yeah, and it's your wall infill. It is fire resistant, mold resistant, and pest resistant. It is also a, breathable wall system, for lack of better term. It is a vapor permeable system, and so it allows the vapor to pass through the wall, creating a better insulating wall, a better performing wall. The fire resistance, the mold resistance, and the pest resistance comes from the lime in the factor, and basically turning back into limestone once the lime-based binder and the water gets mixed with the hemp. It's wanting to turn back into limestone, which it does over time. It makes the wall a thermal mass wall as well, and so it outperforms your conventional wall on all different levels. And so then the testings that have been done with hempcrete, there's different levels of testing in the ASTM that they do for all different building products. And there's different ratings, whether it's a passing grade, a good grade, exceptional, best in class. And hempcrete, almost across the board of all the testings they do, gets best in class. You know, for the fire ratings, they get best in class. There's different ratings that they do or testings for the off-gassing and the VOCs that the building material creates, and they get a zero for that, which is best in class. It doesn't give off any VOCs or any type of toxins like we live in today, is basically all these latex paints and different, you know, fiberglass and plastic materials.
Right, and so it's, right. New homes are giving off all of these different kinds of aerosols and gases. And what you're saying is that as soon as this wall goes up, there's no outgassing of anything that's a problem.
That's right, yep. And so one thing that always gets passed about the hempcrete is it's 100% recyclable. And so our landfills are full of construction waste right now. I think the last thing I seen was 40 to 50% was construction waste in our landfills, whether it's from new builds, remodels, or whatever. Whereas hempcrete is never going to go into your landfill. If you decide to take a wall down or replace your entire house, whatever, you know, you can take that hempcrete, grind it up into your mixer, and put it into your next house, into your next mixes, build the wall out of that. But then the longevity of hempcrete, you won't ever have to do that unless it's just something cosmetic that you don't like. The longevity of hempcrete is it's going to turn into limestone. And so it's basically one monolithic castle wall. You know, we got 12 inches on our walls, and they're, yeah, I mean, it's amazing the way the house performs, and then having these thick walls, it's the sound, I guess, has the sound barrier. But yeah, if anything, if you don't like the way it looks, you could just grind it up and put it into your next mix. And so it's 100% recyclable. It's not going to end up in your landfill.
And it doesn't have to come packaged in a lot of plastic necessarily.
Yeah. And you know, and so technically the way we do it, because we are growing it right on the reservation, and now we are starting to process right on the reservation, we wouldn't really have to ever put it in any plastic wrap if we weren't going to be shipping it out somewhere. You know, we can just, build with it right there.
Yeah.
It all stays right at the house. And so it is.
A question, Danny, is the hemp part of it. I believe that once the hemp is cut down in the fall, it does some laying in the field and rotting, and then it gets processed, and that is where you get this HURD product, H-U-R-D, right? That is what goes into the hempcrete along with the lime in the water. And does the hemp serve a role as like creating air voids that are what help make it a good insulator?
Yeah. So I only spoke about the lime being the star. And so hemp is also a big factor in here too. And so it does create the air voids. And so that is what you get your R value from. But it also has so many tiny pores in the hemp, in the HURD, you know, what we're talking about, the inside of the stem.
Yes.
There's so many pores in that it's able to basically wick any moisture that's in the wall It can transfer that moisture throughout the entire fabric of the wall and release it where it needs to be released, or take it in where it needs to be taken in. It self-regulates humidity and temperature. And while it's doing that, it can pull the moisture where it needs to and disperse it where it needs to. And so that's why you need to leave it able to be vapor permeable. You know, you have to let it, for better terms, breathe. And so,
did I understand that a quality hempcrete wall will kind of almost direct the air quality and the humidity and temperature? It tries to like reach a 64 degree temperature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I find fascinating. I can't believe it's a real benefit. That's close to where we want our houses to live in them in the first place, before you have to add any external heat source.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, that's what we've read and that's what we've been told, is that they want to self-regulate to around 64 degrees. And when we built the first duplex, it wasn't 40 below this winter by any means. And
right.
So there was like a week there where it got really cold, but by then we had already had a furnace and everything in the house. But before the furnace was even placed, on the cold days, I had a thermostat in there and it read 64 degrees, you know, and so it was, I don't know if it was just that's how the house was built, that it stayed 64 degrees, or if it was literally the hempcrete trying to get it to 64 degrees. But when you would go in and read the thing, it was almost always at 64.
And right. So, I'm not trying to quote things that you and I have both heard as if they're, you know, some kind of scientific gospel, because I know that you have plans to make sure that people can see how the house really performs, and that you have an opportunity to have a hempcrete home compared for its performance year round versus a conventional structure of the same size and plan. Can you describe to people what that's going to entail? What are you going to do there?
Yeah, and I came in a skeptic as well, you know, with these claims, and there hadn't been a house built yet in Minnesota, and so where are these claims coming from? You know, we don't know. They say you don't need a furnace, you don't need an air conditioner, and so we really want to be able to test all of these claims that people put out there. And so the duplex that we built, we will have some monitoring in there as well, but we're doing a hempcrete build right next to a conventional build at the same specs. Both of the houses will be the same square footage, same everything, except for one will be built out of hempcrete and one will be conventional. And we will put different sensors in there to test air quality, different energy efficiency, basically any type of sensors and testing that we can do. We will have our own numbers and our own numbers and to back up these claims as well, because we don't even know exactly what the numbers will show yet. And so it's going to be interesting to see, and it's exciting to be able to produce these numbers, because for one of the testings we're going to be working with Penn State, and so they're sending out some students to do testing, and so that'll be really good to have testing backed by a university as well.
And this will have to continue. I mean, I don't know if you have the money or resources to do it, but continue through four seasons of performance, right? Through the extremes that we have. And you have quite the extremes where you live.
Yeah. And so we were blessed to work with Cameron McIntosh from Amerishov out of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And he got a grant through the U.S. Army to test, I guess, the performances of these, different performances of these buildings. And he's sending out a crew from Penn State, and he's paying for all of it through this grant, for all of the equipment and all of the testing, and for the students to come and do it. And so we don't even have to pay for anything, and we're going to get these test results. And so it's
brilliant.
Yeah,
wow.
We're really lucky on that part. And so,
again, we're speaking today with Danny Desjarlais from Lower Sioux Community, and they have got an incredible integrated production building and an agricultural arm to it. We didn't say really anything about the agricultural side of your community figuring out, as you put it earlier on not the best arable land, and what's the experience has been trying to grow your own hemp to use in your production of the building products. Did that start, can have started very long ago, since growing the hemp has only been legal since 2018.
Yeah, I've only been a part of the hemp department for a little over a year, but Earl had, you know, been pushing this hemp thing for so long that when it did become legal in 2018, he had already had it set up with, I think he might, it might have been the through the state or the U of M or somebody, I don't know exactly who he had it set up through, where they had a special permit, and we were actually able to grow right away that first year.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, right away, as soon as we could grow hemp legally, we were growing hemp legally. And so it's been a challenge, I guess, trying to find the right variety, and I guess the sure. right variety basically is the main thing. We don't have a lot of acreage to begin with, and so we got to try and make sure the acres we do use, we get the most out of. And so we've tried different varieties here and there from, you know, different parts of the world. And this year we have some other guy that's going to come in and teach us about different varieties. And so we're still experimenting with that. But even if we found the perfect variety that grew the most hemp we could get out of each acre, it wouldn't matter because we don't have enough acres to,
right. So where are you heading to? Because you're trying to produce and build a larger scale, it sounds like, every year. Will you be trying to find outside farmers to take on interest in growing hemp?
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely the goal, is to get other people farming along with us, whether it's local farmers or other tribes that get into the industry. It doesn't really matter. You know, anybody, we would partner with anybody once we get our facility up and running. You know, we can't really reach out to these farmers yet until we have our processing up and running and we have a place for these farmers to bring their product. You know, these farmers want contracts, and they want to know, okay, I have a place to actually bring it to. And so once we have that building, then we'll be able to reach out to local farmers and other tribes, but we just don't have the land mass to be able to. If we wanted to really go to scale on the production, we would definitely need more acreage or more farmers growing for us.
So I heard you talking about your processing facility there, and in fact, you've broken ground. I don't know how far, what's the status of this facility? And it's going to be a pretty large industrial process that you're starting on your land, right?
So just the farming is a whole industry in itself, and then the processing is another industry. The building on site is an industry, and then if you're manufacturing prefabricated hempcrete blocks or panels, that's a whole other industry. And we're trying to do all four of those at once without a market being developed for any of these, you know. And so it sounds crazy, but it's just
right.
That's how far ahead thinking Earl was on this, you know. And so with the processing, that's going to be the challenge, is because in the U.S., we don't really have a whole lot of blueprints to go off of or other processors. They've been doing it in France and Europe for a while, but here in the U.S., we don't have that down. And so we do have a facility up and up. It won't be running until late this spring. I think they said we can start moving our equipment in late April. And so as long as we can get it up and running, you know, by this next year, and we can, then we can really get into the farmers' ears and get going on that. But it's a huge, I guess, a whole industrial endeavor we're going down with just the processing alone. You know, I think if there was enough farmers growing in the area, just doing the processing would be enough income right there. You know,
right.
Like we wouldn't have to be growing and doing all this if we were just looking for revenue. I think just one of these industries alone is enough to generate some good revenue.
Right. So you've got four parallel tracks, and maybe over time you'll have less invested in the agricultural side, but it sure sounds like you're going all in on the processing and the building.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have been going all in on the farming as well. You know, like we've been farming as much
as
of the land as we can.
Yeah.
And before now, we hadn't even grown any corn or soybeans. We haven't grown any cash crops for our community, you know. And so this opened doors for other things as well, you know. And so now we're growing soybeans and corn. And
oh, is that right?
The jobs that hemp can create just with the hemp is, you know, just the farming. And then if you think of just the processing or the building, there's just so much potential for different jobs.
Again, I'm speaking with Danny DeJarlais from Lower Sioux Community, and I could go on a long time, Danny, and I talked to you for 20 minutes before we even started recording this interview. But I'm gonna have to kind of leave people in a little bit of suspense because we probably raised more questions than we've answered, and we haven't even talked about the different building projects that you've done and what you're planning other than that side-by-side comparison house. But I know you created emergency housing on your tribal land. Can you remind me about that? That was the project last year?
Yeah, so that project began in June. That was our first project as a crew. So the guys all got hired June 27th, and that's when we started building the first house. It was a side-by-side duplex, and that's when we brought Cameron McIntosh in from Pennsylvania to teach us how to use the spray technology, the Ereasy spray technology. So that was the first house we built. It's a 2 one-bedroom units that are side-by-side. It's a duplex, and it's going to be used as temporary emergency housing. That was done, like I said, with the spray technology, and then we also did the 4-bedroom, but that was done where you just place the hempcrete by hand.
Right. So, is that called cast-in-place? I know you're mixing on-site and packing into forms.
Yep, and so it's just cast-in-place. It's basically just filling buckets and going and putting it into forms, whereas the sprayer, you still have to mix it on site, but then it's just coming out of a sprayer. One guy is controlling the sprayer and filling the wall cavities.
Well, I think I'm going to have to get back to where the punchline of the whole interview is. Danny, what you're doing is very inspiring to people probably from all walks of life. I certainly think it probably is to other tribal nations who may have land that might be able to grow a fair amount of the product that is needed for hempcrete industry. It's just very exciting. We don't know how fast this will take off and where it's going, but some representatives from your community are going to be up in Two Harbors on March 10th to talk to folks about hempcrete. Do you know who I'd be meeting then and what they'll maybe bring to show us?
Yeah, so it'll be my crew and myself and then our farmer as well, our hemp farmer.
Okay.
We're going to try and bring as much as we can of blocks and different. We have some small, like, display walls that look basically just smaller hempcrete walls, tiny hempcrete walls. They're only display. They're not, like, you wouldn't use them in a house or anything.
But right.
Yeah, I guess we'll bring that, and we'll all be there.
Well, like everywhere that you go, there are people who have been in the building trades for a long time, and they may come to it skeptical, full of questions like you once had, Danny, but it sounds like you have some pretty good answers, so I think it might be some really good sharing of questions and good answers that might get some people thinking and kind of set the stage for people being willing to try this building form. I know we've seen other unconventional buildings happen here, from straw bales to even what they call log infill. And I think the hempcrete is a great way to go. You know, on paper, I still have to kind of see it to believe it. I know that sounds silly, but it's sort of, you know.
No, that doesn't sound silly. Because that's how I was, too. I was the skeptic coming in as well. And, yeah, I welcome all questions at that presentation while we're up there, because I'm still looking for the, as Earl calls it, the fly in the ointment. You know, we can't find it yet. And so if any of these contractors or builders can help us find it, that would be great, because I've been looking and I can't find it.
Are you set in your tribal land setting? Do you still have housing needs? Are you thinking that you're going to be able to address some of the less than adequate housing that needs refurbishment, and the fact that you probably need new homes? Is there a plan in place to address all that?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that's the thing we always miss on this one of the layers into this whole project, is it's already created jobs for our community members. All the guys on the crew are community members, you know. And then now we can go out and build these houses for our community members, for our family members. And I think that's the biggest part about it, you know, being able to address this housing shortage right here on the reservation with our own people. It's really empowering. And I think it's the perfect blueprint for any community, whether it's tribal or not, you know. And I think just the growing hemp in itself, you know, whether you're not going to start building right away, I mean, just the growing hemp, it sequesters so much carbon while it's growing, and it's such a short growing period compared to trees. You know, it's like we need to start giving Mother Earth a little bit of a break here, you know, and I think hemp is a good way to start doing that.
If I recall right, if we're going to talk about climate change impacts, it's the growing of the hemp is largely carbon neutral or better. And then when you get these walls put up, they actually absorb carbon over time, the petrification process.
Yeah. And so, when you're growing the hemp, I mean, you're sequestering so much carbon, you know, it's like 2 to 4 times as much as a forest at the same acre. And then it gives off, I don't remember how much more oxygen than a forest. And so when it's growing, you know, the hemp itself is sequestering so much carbon, and then you got to use equipment to cut it down. And so the entire embodied carbon of the whole building's material, when it's all done, you know, the factors that they bring in, whether it's the machinery used to cut it down, then you add in even the machinery it takes to black the lime, to get the lime down to what you need to use it. Yep. They add all of that in. Then you add it into a building material, it's still a carbon negative building material after it's put into the wall. Well, I guess depending on how you put it into the wall, it might be right at, might not be carbon negative, but it'd probably be pretty close to zero. But then it's also sequestering carbon out of the air when it's turning back into limestone. And so over the time of it petrifying, yes, it's sucking up carbon. Not as much as when it's growing, obviously, but it's still sequestering carbon throughout the life of the wall, which is pretty incredible.
It is.
And so it becomes a carbon sink, you know. It becomes just you got all these companies and these big companies that want to get to net zero carbon by 2050 or whatever they claim, you know, all these big companies that want to do that. Well, they should all start growing hemp, and they should all start building with hempcrete if they want to do that, you know, because that's going to be a good way to start lessening your carbon footprint.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. The fact that the wall that no longer has roots in the ground is still absorbing any carbon is unlike any building product I've ever talked about, Danny. So I can't wait to find out more from you. March 10th, it's a Sunday, and it will have the great hall of our local high school, Two Harbors High School, full of folks who have come to hopefully ask you questions and get some answers and see for themselves. Can't wait to meet you and your crew, Danny. Thanks for talking to me at length today and sharing your expertise and your enthusiasm and your thoughtful approach to this. I think we're going to have fun on March 10th, and I'm glad you're coming a long way to be with us.
Yeah, we're looking forward to coming up there. So I've never been to Two Harbors. I hear it's beautiful.
We find it so. We've got this nice little lake out the front door here. The Gichigami is very impressive, and we hope you enjoy your stay. And going to be a lot of sharing of information and hopefully enthusiasm. So thanks for coming a long way and for visiting with me today on KTWH.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Danny. Take care. We'll see you soon. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye.
That was Danny Desjarlais, who is the Industrial Hemp Construction Project Manager for the Lower Sioux Community, the Mdewakanton people of the Minnesota River Valley, who are doing an integrated production of the product we call hempcrete. And they'll be demonstrating that product and talking about how it's grown, processed, and built with on March 10th. At the Great Hall of Two Harbors High School, the Native Nations Expo takes place from 1 to 3 p.m., and then at 3 p.m., the Cabin Fever Reliever Show, the benefit for community radio in Two Harbors. This is Leo for KTWH.